Turning to today's event, we've got a speaker I've been longing to get for a long time because I'm an enormous admirer of hers, Christina Lamb, who is one of Britain's leading foreign correspondents and also a best-selling author. She's reported from most of the world's hotspots, but her particular passions are Afghanistan and Pakistan, which she's covered since an unexpected wedding invitation led her to Karachi in 1987 when she was just 21. Within 2 years, she'd been named the Young Journalist of the Year. Since then, she's won many numerous awards, I won't go through them all. Last year, she won Amnesty International's Newspaper Journalist of the Year for reporting from inside Libyan detention centres. And she's currently Chief Foreign Correspondent for the Sunday Times here in London. I'm not going to say any more because I'm going to allow her to speak, but she has written a number of books. Her latest books are Farewell Kabul, From Afghanistan to a More Dangerous World, and New Gene, One Girl's Incredible Journey from War-Torn Syria in a Wheelchair. Both of them are for sale here at the back of the room. If you'd like to buy one, I'm sure that Christina would be happy to sign a copy for you. But without more ado, I get to ask Christina to speak to us about 15 years after 9/11, the Jihad Museum, and what went wrong in Afghanistan. Christina.
Thanks, Michael. Good afternoon. Thank you very much for that introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here. And I'm always a little bit wary about talking at lunchtime events because the very first time I did that was at a beautiful Scottish village called Pitlochry, where I was speaking at a literary lunch. And when I went in, they told me to sit down at a table and eat. And then when the dessert came, I should pop up and start speaking. So I wasn't actually introduced. So I sat at a table and there was an old lady next to me and she said to me, "Have you come far for this event?" So I said, "Well, I've come from London." So she looked at me and she said, "You've come all the way from London to hear Christina Lamb speak." So very naughtily, I didn't say who I was. And I noticed she didn't buy my book afterwards. So I just, on the way here, I was just looking at the front pages of the papers and, of course, all the stuff about Calais and the jungle. And it was just reminding me about a trip that I did to Calais, to the jungle, a year ago. And I just thought I'd just start with that, because some of you might not know quite how foreign correspondents work, and it gives a little bit of insight into our lives. So I have a son who had just finished his GCSEs, it was actually June last year, and was hanging around with nothing to do. I was told by the paper to go to Calais, and to basically it was when there was that strike of the trucks, and there was this long queue of people, and a lot of the migrants were jumping on the trucks. So they wanted me to go out with the migrants at night, and as they were trying to jump on trucks. And it was supposed to just be an overnight trip. So I said to my son, "Why don't you come with me?" I'd never, ever taken him on an assignment before, but I thought France nearby, just one night, easy, and it would be good for him to see how these kids live in this camp. So we go, and we went to the camp, and it was actually great having him with me because, as you've seen, there's quite a lot of young people in the camp, and they really liked talking to him, and they talked to him differently than the way they would talk to me. Then we went out that night. We were with a photographer who's an old friend, so we went out, did watch them trying to jump on the trucks, came back about 4 o'clock in the morning, went to bed, got up the next morning, which was Friday, quite late, went for a leisurely breakfast, and then I was going to then write my long piece, and we were working out where we might go for a nice French lunch afterwards. And my phone rings, and it's the Sunday Times foreign desk saying that there's been a beheading in Grenoble, and we've booked you on a train in about 20 minutes. So I had to abandon breakfast. I left my son with the photographer, jumped on the train, and started heading towards Paris. While I was on the train, I was, of course, checking Twitter and things, what's going on, and I see that there's been an attack in Tunisia, in Sousse. So I call my foreign editor and say, "Are you sure you don't want me to go to Tunisia instead of Grenoble?" And he said, no, we're covered. So I thought, well, okay. So I continue, I get to Paris, I change train to go south of France. I'm on that train when I then get a phone call from the foreign editor saying, actually, we've changed our minds and you are booked on a flight to Tunis. And I'm like, okay, but now I'm sort of halfway from Paris south. So I had to get the train back. When I arrived to Paris, it was the day that there was a huge taxi strike because of Uber, and they were all protesting, so there were no taxis to be had. So finally I found a train to the station. I literally got there just as they were closing the flight, ran on, got this flight to Tunis, arrive about midnight on the Friday night. Now, Sousse is about 3 hours' drive from Tunis, so I got to Sousse about 3 or 4 in the morning on the Saturday. So then went to bed, and knowing that I'd got to do this big story the next morning about this massacre, which by then we knew a lot of British, I mean, I think in the end it was 32 people, 32 British tourists had been killed. But it was obviously something huge. So I go to bed, get up early so I could go out after just having a few hours sleep. Meanwhile, I discover that my son and the photographer, the car hit a curb leaving from Calais, so the tyres burst, so they got stuck there. So I was trying to sort of negotiate how to get my son back as well. And as I was setting off to go and start reporting on what happened in Sousse, I then get a message saying, we still need this story about the Calais jungle, which I hadn't written in all of this running around. So I had to quickly write that, then go and try and find what had happened in Sousse. And Sousse was quite difficult because people were in 4 different hospitals spread around. So I was sort of running from one place to another. And of course, with very helpful people from the news desk endlessly phoning me saying, oh, we've just heard there's a British victim in this hospital or that hospital or places that were very far from where I was. So I tell you that story just to give a little bit of insight into how crazy our lives are sometimes. And also because I just wanted to illustrate, I've been a foreign correspondent, as Michael said, since 87 when I was 21, so you can all work out how old I am. And so that's a long time, right? That's almost 30 years. I have never been as busy as a foreign correspondent as I am now. There seem to be things everywhere, terrorist attacks, wars, and we just also, of course, newspapers have fewer people to cover them. And so, you know, we can't get to all these places. I also think there's a limit to public appetite of how much they want to read about people being killed in all of these places. So it's because of that, in a way, I think that we read very little about what's happening in Afghanistan, which I find very frustrating. And this talk's actually very timely, which I'd like to say that Michael and I had planned deliberately. But in fact, coincidentally, it's exactly 2 years since the closure of the British base in Bastion. It was 2 years tomorrow, which marked the end of British combat operations in Afghanistan, and which I have to say involved a very impressive airlift of 17 waves of helicopters and planes out. Now, the British government would like people to think that that was, in fact, the end of the war in Afghanistan. And I'm ashamed that, partly for the reasons I just said, that the British media has very much played into that by not really covering it since then. And as some of you here may be well aware, actually, the situation has got far worse, and far more Afghans have been killed since we left than at any time during the war. But I'll talk a little bit more of that later. The other reason that this talk is very timely, which it does say on your handouts, is it is 15 years this month since the start of the American forces attacking Afghanistan to root out Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden after 9/11 and to topple the Taliban regime that hosted them. I don't think we ever imagined then that 15 years on, we would not only still be fighting the Taliban, but we'd once more have war on our TV screens every night, this time against another even more deadly Islamic terrorist group. I don't know if any of you read my piece in the Sunday Times magazine about the rape of the Yazidi girls, but that story was the worst story that I've ever had to write. I mean, girls as young as 8 being raped over and over again by these guys who, in my view, are certainly the most monstrous people that I have ever covered. So one of the things that I argue in my book, Farewell Kabul, is how short-term decisions that we make on policy so often lead to really long-term terrifying consequences. And I detail something that I believe, which is that you can really trace the roots of ISIS back to the Western encouragement of jihadis to fight against the Soviet Union in the 1980s in Afghanistan. And I decided to write this book, which is quite long, as my mum said, because I was angry that I felt that I had seen many friends and soldiers killed in this war. And I wanted really to answer the question for myself of whether it was worth it. 3,500 NATO troops killed, including 456 British, and tens of thousands who lost their limbs or were scarred in other ways. Not to mention around 100,000 Afghans killed and about $800 billion spent. I think Afghanistan should be more on our radar screen because I think it would be terrible if after all that sacrifice, the country would go back to Taliban control. I've actually spent the last 18 months mostly reporting on the refugee crisis engulfing Europe, which, as you know, is the worst refugee crisis since World War II. While most of the focus of that has been on the Syrians that have come over, actually the second biggest number of refugees are Afghans. There's been 250,000 Afghans coming into Europe. Last month I was in a camp in Greece, an island of Leros, and I met a lovely 16-year-old Afghan girl called Chuba, who told me that she had left Afghanistan with her family because she'd been learning English. And she lived in a village in northern Afghanistan, which was an area that didn't used to be under Taliban influence. And the Taliban had come there and said to her father, "Your daughter is learning a heathen language and actually shouldn't be learning anything at all. And so if you don't stop this, we are going to kill her." And he, to start with, didn't do anything. Then other people in the village all came to him and said, "The Taliban are about to come and kill you all." So they fled and ended up making their way all the way to Greece. Unfortunately, they got there after the deal was done on 23rd of March, which closed the borders. So they are still, like so many people, stuck in a camp on one of the islands. And it was very sad because this girl spoke fluent English. And she said, "You know, the reason we fled was because of education. I wanted to be educated. And now I'm in this camp in Greece. I don't go to school. I don't have anything to do. And I'm just stuck." Unfortunately, their prospects don't look very good because you probably saw earlier this month when there was the donors meeting on Afghanistan, the deal was Afghanistan gets $15 billion but takes back its refugees from Europe. And the fact is, these people would not be leaving and making these really difficult journeys unless the situation was so bad. And the Taliban now are not just in their traditional areas in the south and the east, but actually moving into areas that they never had any influence at all before. And when that meeting was going on in Brussels and people were all posing for their photo shoot about giving money to Afghanistan, actually that very same day the Taliban were storming the northern city of Kunduz, Afghanistan's fifth largest city, which they captured briefly last year, and also threatening Lashkargah, where our troops used to be based in Helmand. And there was a report, some of you might have seen in the Washington Post from Helmand at the weekend, which says that 85% of Helmand is now under Taliban control. And it actually quoted a military expert from the US saying, "We're doing just enough to lose slowly." Now, if that wasn't bad enough, we now also have ISIS, Daesh, in Afghanistan, in the east. So the country that we went into to sort of end it being a safe haven for terrorists is now once again a base for terrorists. So I want to talk a little bit about what went wrong. How come 140,000 NATO troops with all the latest technology and missiles that cost the price of a Porsche could not defeat 20,000 Taliban? I think I'd just start a little bit by telling you why I care so much about Afghanistan. As Michael said, it all started for me with a wedding. After I left university, I worked as an intern at the Financial Times. And one day the foreign editor was supposed to be going to a lunch of South Asian politicians. And last minute he couldn't go. So he said to me, "You're always going on about India. Why don't you go to this?" So I went and I sat next to somebody who was the Secretary General of the Pakistan People's Party, Benazir Bhutto's party. And he said to me, "Would you like to interview Benazir?" At that time, she was living here in London in exile. So, of course, I said yes. And so he arranged for me to go and interview her. And the day I went to interview her was the day that she announced her engagement to Asif Ali Zardari. So the apartment was absolutely full of bouquets of flowers. We got on very well. She then went back to Pakistan. I went to Birmingham, less exotically, to be a trainee at Central Television. And one day I came home from work and there was this most beautiful gold inscribed invitation on my mat, and it was to her wedding in Karachi. So of course I went, and it was like something out of Arabian Nights. If any of you have been to South Asian weddings, you'll know that they go on for a long time and they're very colourful. And this was really spectacular. And I couldn't really imagine going back to reporting local news in Birmingham after seeing this. Not least because every evening after all the ceremonial events of the wedding, there would be gatherings with her political colleagues about how to try and topple Pakistan's then military dictator, General Zia. So I was fascinated. So I came back and went and talked to lots of newspapers about going to Pakistan. And actually, nobody was interested. They all said, "Oh, General Zia's been there 11 years, nothing's going to change." But they said to me, "We are interested in Afghanistan," because the Russians were there at the time in occupation. So, you know, I didn't actually set out to be a war correspondent. It happened by accident. And so I gave him my notice, and the very last story I did for Central TV was about a man who turned his car back to front, so it looked like it was going forwards when it was going backwards. I don't think I was a great loss to television. And I set off for Peshawar to start to try and become a foreign correspondent. Actually, I had no idea what foreign correspondents did or what they needed. And I had this case with a giant bag of wine gums and a copy of Rudyard Kipling's Kim. And a trade bottle someone had got me of Chanel No. 5. And this was a long time ago, so I didn't have a laptop. I had a Tandy word processor, do you remember those? Where you could see just three lines of green on green. And I used to file my copy either by telex. When I talk to young people, I have to explain what a telex was. And I also had to dictate to copy takers. And some of the stories I was doing, for a while I was the Express is our girl in Kabul, but I was also filing for the Sunday Times, and the copy takers for the Sunday Times are the same as for the Sun, because it's the same company. And they were used to quite short stories, and I was doing these long dispatches, so I would be dictating, and after sort of two paragraphs, the copy taker would say, "Is there much more of this?" Which is very demoralising. But it was a very exciting time, obviously, to be there. And actually, I didn't have a clue where even to stay. And I asked a rickshaw driver to take me to a cheap hotel. And he took me to a place called Green's Hotel, which turned out to be where arms dealers stayed. Actually, somebody tried to sell me a Chinese multi-barrel rocket launcher for breakfast. So it was, I remember the first night there, kind of looking out the window and seeing these mountains silhouetted in the distance and thinking that beyond lay Afghanistan. And I thought about all the people who had tried to cross those mountains and conquer Afghanistan. So Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, Tamerlane, Baba, the first Mughal emperor, and of course the British three times. And while I was there, as I said, the Russians were there, and that's what I was covering. Now, because I didn't really know what foreign correspondents did, there were seven different groups fighting the Russians, seven different resistance groups. And actually, most journalists who were experienced just found out which groups were the sort of key ones that could actually do useful things and were effective, and went to speak to them. But I didn't really know that, so I thought I'll go and speak to all seven groups, which meant that I went to the smallest group of all, which was Professor Mujahidi's group, and his spokesperson was a certain Hamid Karzai, who was delighted to have a foreign journalist come speak to him, because very few did. And he was also, in those days, a great Anglophile. He'd studied in Simla, he loved English poetry, loved Tennyson and Somerset Maugham stories and Cadbury's chocolate. So we got on very well. And he said to me, if you want to understand Afghanistan, you have to understand the tribes of Afghanistan. So come to my house for dinner. So I went to his house, and it was full of elders from Helmand and Kandahar and Uruzgan and Nimruz, all of whom had most amazing stories, mostly involving killing people. And they loved having a captive audience in this young girl. So I started going to his house most of the time to meet these people, and started learning about all the different tribes and which tribe had feuds with which other tribe, and the Alazai and the Noorzai and the Alakazai, and realized that this was way more complicated than the Russians against the Mujahideen. It was actually an incredibly intricate society. So they had gathered together because Afghans always want to drive out the outsider, but it was quite clear that they pretty much hated each other as much as they hated the Russians, and so long term this was going to be very complicated. So when I wasn't at Hamid Karzai's house, I used to go to a place where most of the journalists hung out, which was called the American Club, and where you could get hot dogs and beers. And that was in University Town in Peshawar, just along the road from the guest house where Osama bin Laden used to bring Arabs to come and fight in a jihad. And at that time, I'd never heard of Osama bin Laden. I knew about the Arabs that were coming to fight. The Afghans, for the most part, didn't like them. They were scared of them. And I did hear about this rich Arab who had brought in bulldozers to dig tunnels. But I must say, I never heard anybody use the name bin Laden then. And some of the journalists that I knew at the time that now say, oh, I interviewed bin Laden then, I slightly doubt, because I think none of us knew who he was at that time. And then, of course, we were all on the same side. We were all fighting the Russians. It was part of the Cold War. And the aim was to defeat the Soviet Union. And so to do this, the CIA, MI6, encouraged the use of these jihadi fighters, many of whom were bad guys in their own countries. They were former convicts that Arab states were only too happy to get rid of. Of course, never did we imagine that those Arabs would become fanatical terrorists who would fly planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, or that one of them, the Jordanian gangster Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, would end up going to Iraq to foment sectarian strife, which would eventually lead to ISIS. And going back to do this book, I went through all my notebooks back to 87, and it's quite chilling when you reread some of the interviews you did with people. And actually, Michael and I, just before we started, were talking about somebody called General Hamid Gul, who was the Director General of Pakistan's ISI, Military Intelligence, who kind of created the Taliban. And I had a quote from him in my notebook from 1989, where he said, "You in the West think you can use these fundamentalists as cannon fodder, then abandon them, but it will come back to haunt you." Of course, at that time, it never occurred to me that I would indeed be back years later covering my own country fighting in Afghanistan. I think it's easy to forget now, but after 9/11, the first part of the campaign in Afghanistan, it seemed like a great success. I actually start my book at Christmas 2001, sitting on the roof of a place called the Mustafa Hotel, where journalists were used to stay, and which had the seat of an old Soviet MiG fighter on the roof. And sitting there and hearing music, which had been banned for so long by the Taliban, and seeing kids playing in the streets, boys flying kites, which had been banned, the first snow falling, and it really felt like a happy ending. I don't get many happy endings in my job, and that felt like one. The whole operation had only cost $3.8 billion and took only 5 Western lives, a CIA agent and 4 American soldiers. And 3 of those were actually killed by an American bomb. And I spoke to Lieutenant Colonel Rob Fry, who was Commandant of the Royal Marines at the time, and some of you might know. And he said to me, all of a sudden, we thought we'd found the Philosopher's Stone of intervention. Of course, we should have known better, and it ended up being the longest ever war for America and Britain's longest war since the Hundred Years' War. And despite declaring our war over 2 years ago, we do still have some troops there, which a lot of people don't seem to realise. We have about 500 troops. There's around 12,000 NATO troops, which are mostly American troops. And recently, Obama actually had to relax the rules of engagement for those troops, which was from train, advise and assist, to actually engage again because of the situation, because it turns out it's not so easy. We discovered that Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, was dead, and he was then replaced by Mullah Mansour, and he was eliminated by an American drone. But the new leader, Mullah Akhundzada, seems to have encouraged them to fight on, and they have made considerable inroads, I would say, in much of the country. Poppy production, which was one of the things we were concerned about for heroin, which also funds the Taliban, much of that heroin ends up on the streets of London, was actually up 43% last year. Then, as I mentioned earlier, civilian deaths in Afghanistan are at an all-time high. There was 3,545 civilians killed last year, half of them women and children, and 5,000 Afghan forces. You have 1.2 million Afghans fleeing their home, and Kabul has become so dangerous that now when diplomats go there, they actually take a helicopter for the 1 mile between the airport and the embassies. And I think one of the most worrying things is the casualties among Afghan forces, because they're, after all, the people we hoped we'd leave this to take on the Taliban. And I believe that they are at completely unsustainable levels. In 1 week alone, in August, more than 100 Afghan troops were killed and 300 injured. And that's leading to very low morale among the Afghan forces. And you're seeing on almost a daily basis what they call strategic retreats. We might call abandoning checkpoints to the Taliban. The new chief of police in Helmand, when he went there, he said he'd been told that he'd got 26,000 security forces. And when he got there, he found that actually 26,000 might be receiving a salary, but he only had 40% of that. Basically, it appears the only reason that Lashkargah has not fallen to the Taliban is because the Americans have sent forces back to Camp Shorab in Bastion. So, while our focus is very much on ISIS at the moment, are we in danger of losing Afghanistan, and has it all been a waste of time? Well, first of all, I don't think the Taliban are about to take Kabul. But, as I said, their writ extends far beyond where it was when we left. And in terms of what we've achieved, I don't think it is all a waste of time. Afghanistan has a much better health system, much better education. There's about 9 million children in schools, compared to about a million before. But there's still a long way to go. Half the children in Afghanistan have never set foot in a classroom. One of the things that makes me laugh when NATO give these sort of legacy presentations about what's been achieved is that they cite this figure that 19 million mobile phones in Afghanistan. And I kind of think, well, did we really go into Afghanistan to spread the joys of Vodafone? But actually, I mean, it's not completely trivial, because when I went to Afghanistan the first time, when the Russians were there, it was completely cut off from the rest of the world. Now it's a very connected place, even in really remote places. So I was in a northern province called Samarkand a year or so ago, one of the poorest parts of the country, all these really abandoned villages. And I was sitting in one village with a group of elders, and to my astonishment, the phone rang, and one of these long-bearded elders took out a smartphone. So I said, how many of you have got phones? And honestly, there's 18 of these elders in a line. They all held up their smartphones. And then they said to me, and we're on Facebook too. So I was like, who do you Facebook? And they said, our wives. But then they explained to me that these phones have actually made a huge difference to their lives, because they're subsistence farmers. They produce wheat. Once a year, a man comes from Mazar-e-Sharif, buys the wheat. And in the past, they didn't, you know, they just sold it for whatever he said, because they didn't have any other option. Now they can phone the market in Mazar-e-Sharif and discover how much wheat should be sold for. And so they are making more money. But the negative effect of these phones is that when you've got a phone, you can see how people live in the rest of the world, and you might decide it's better to leave Afghanistan and go to one of those places. Because for all the billions that's been spent on Afghanistan, it remains one of the poorest places on earth. I think a third of the population lives on less than 80 pence a day. And as for an issue which is very close to my heart, which is women's rights, and you might remember that after toppling the Taliban, one of the things that Bush and Blair talked about was how we were bringing freedom to women. There are some good things. I've met female rappers in Afghanistan. There's a girls' coding school, even. But honestly, many Afghans are still living in fear. 60% of marriages in Afghanistan are forced marriages, often with very young children. And some of those women that we in the West encourage to go and put their head above the parapet, go to international conferences, run for office, do this, to speak at conferences, are living in fear of their lives, and we are not there to protect them now. Some of them have been killed, some of them are in hiding. I get endless messages from some of these women on WhatsApp, and it's heartbreaking. And you might remember last year the awful case of Fakunda, the trainee teacher who was killed by a mob in the middle of Kabul. She was beaten, then she was run over, she was set fire to, she was thrown off a roof, and finally she was thrown in the Kabul River. Now, this happened in Kabul, about a mile from the presidential palace, in the middle of the day. And it wasn't sort of uneducated, remote people in villages. It was young men, young urban Kabulis, who posted what they had done on Facebook, as if they were proud of it, on YouTube. So that seems to me to show how far Afghanistan still has to go in women's rights. And sadly, I mean, all of us have tried to do some of these good news stories about women, and one of them was the Afghan Women's Cycling Club. And that turns out that the guy that was running it was actually using the cycling club as a harem and also as a sort of personal piggy bank. And so he was raping the women, taking all the money from the foreigners, and apparently the only bicycling they really ever did was going round and round a roundabout in the middle of Kabul. So, you know, it's hard to be very positive about that. Now, as you remember, one of the arguments given for why we were in Afghanistan was national security, that we fight them there so as not to fight them here. I just wonder how many people feel safer today than they did before we went in. Because it seems to me, and as I was saying at the beginning, that there is just so many conflicts going on. It feels like those whack-a-mole games where you sort of stamp one out in one place and one springs up somewhere else. And, I mean, we still have the Taliban in Afghanistan. We also have the Pakistan Taliban. We have AQAP in Yemen. We have the Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb. We have Boko Haram in Nigeria, where I spent a couple of weeks earlier this year, and probably they're the most brutal of all. They've killed maybe 20,000 people and abducted and forcibly married thousands of women. And then, of course, we have Daesh, or Islamic State, which not only is carrying out its sort of horrible reign of beheadings in Iraq and Syria, but also attract a lot of Westerners to go and fight. And just to make matters more complicated, we seem to be on the same side as some people in one place, and then on the other side from them in another place. So, for example, the battle at the moment to take Mosul, we're on the same side as the Iranian-backed militia, but in Syria next door, we're on the other side. So my job has really never been so busy or so complicated, which is not a good thing. And I just want to say briefly a little bit more about why things went wrong in Afghanistan, because I think if we understood that, we might understand why it is we can't end wars anymore. I don't think anyone really comes out well from my book. I'm not going to spare the military, I know there are some present, but in my view the problem was political more than military. It seemed to me after the initial stage we never really knew what we were trying to do in Afghanistan, and we didn't understand what we were going into. A lot of people afterwards questioned why we hadn't learnt from history. I mean, British, after all, had fought three wars there, which we lost two, and there's the famous rule number one from Harold Macmillan, which is never invade Afghanistan. But, you know, there was a more recent lesson to learn from. And if you go to Herat, which is my favourite city in Afghanistan, a warlord has built an amazing rotunda on top of a hill to house something which is called the Jihad Museum. And inside, it's full of captured Russian weapons, tanks and guns, and even MiG fighter jets. And it's also got an amazing gallery of very garish portraits of warlords who fought against the Russians. And then if you go right to the top, you have their Pride and Joy, which is this sound and light exhibition of defeating the Russians. It's incredibly gruesome, and it comes complete with sort of bullet sounds and blood-curdling screams, and I've never seen anything quite like it. And this warlord, General Wahab, who was behind it, he said to me very proudly, not only do we have all these captured Russian weapons and displays, but we have an actual Russian. So I said, what do you mean? And it turns out that the guide in this museum is a man who was a Russian soldier who got captured during the Russian war in Afghanistan and ended up staying there and then ended up marrying an Afghan woman. And he is now the guide of the Jihad Museum. And General Wahab said to me, when he dies, he will be buried here and then we will have a dead Russian. So I don't think anyone could go to that museum and think that invading Afghanistan was a good idea. And I spoke to the Russian ambassador afterwards, who'd really spent a lot of time in Afghanistan. He'd done three tours, he'd been there then, he'd been subsequently, and then he was again, and he spoke fluent Pashto, which is pretty much the only diplomat I met did. And I said to him, did anyone from NATO come and speak to you or any of the Russians before going in after 9/11? And he said no, which I found quite amazing. And I said, what would you have said if they had come? And he said, I would have told them, Afghanistan is very easy to get into and very hard to get out. I think I'll end there so we have plenty of time for questions.